The following is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University.
My name is Dan Metcalf, and I'm speaking here from the American University Washington College of Law in Washington, D.C., where we're about to do something that's never quite been done before in multiple respects. By that, I mean to say we're going to be holding the first ever event celebrating International Rights and No Day in the United States. And we're going to be doing it through the kind participation of our international colleagues in three different locations in the world, spanning, I guess, a total of three continents. And that's it. We're using England and Paris, London and Paris at the same time, not necessarily, and I decided to go right there. Before I introduce our speakers, what I'd like to do is just say a few words about International Rights and No Day to begin with. It's something that is very much akin to something we've been celebrating in the United States now for many years, and that's Freedom of Information Day, annual Freedom of Information Day, I should say, which is celebrated here in the United States on March 16th, the birthday of James Madison, who was the intellectual grandfather, so to speak, of openness in government in many respects. And that has blossomed over the years so that it's more than just holding events on March 16th, annual Freedom of Information Day. It's now become an entire week. A number of media and library organizations have taken FOIA Day and enhanced it into Sunshine Week, the entire week surrounding that. Now, International Rights and No Day is something that is modeled on that, and it began 6 years ago on September 28th in Sofia, Bulgaria, when a number of what we would call public interest groups in the United States, or NGOs, non-government organizations, or civil society members in Europe, got together and decided that given that openness in government was blossoming so heavily throughout the world, that it was time to have worldwide recognition of that. And thereafter, ever since that first September 28th in Bulgaria in 2002, this day has been celebrated. So this makes this the fifth annual celebration, the first one being the following year in 2003. And now there are approximately 70 nations of the world that have a transparency regime, one form or another. It depends upon how you want to count a little bit. One nation has it by presidential edict, that's Argentina. A few other nations have it in different ways, forms. But the primary point is that the world went from having just a handful of openness and government regimes even as late as the early 1980s, to now having dozens and dozens of nations that are spreading this throughout the world. And it's being used not only as an essential element of democracy, a cornerstone of democracy, to have an informed citizenry that can allow people to exercise their franchise in a democratic system, but increasingly, in many places in the world, it's become a very potent tool for combating corruption. And that's certainly the case most recently in nations of Central Latin America and South America, where openness in government or international transparency has been on the march, so to speak, and there's much, much room for that being the case in Africa as well. There's a lot of room to grow there, that's for sure. Now, the three groups of people we have that we're so pleased to have participating today are from three different locations, London and Paris and New Zealand, actually represent three distinct aspects of the international transparency movement. The first, in the UK, is where we have what we in the United States think of as a relatively recent member of the International Transparency Club, because the UK came online, so to speak, with a law that took effect 2.5, actually it's getting close to 3 years now, States, but all the way down to the smallest unit of governmental activity. I believe the last number I heard was about 110,000 governmental units are subject to the UK's Freedom of Information Law. And they are ahead of the curve, so to speak, in relation to the United States, and that they are already focusing quite actively on refining the law, moving it forward beyond the point of initial enactment and initial implementation, so we can get better and better as time goes by. It took the United States, by the way, many years to reach that point, so the UK is learning from our mistakes and we have people there who are very much involved in that process. Secondly, in Paris, we have participation from UNESCO, and that is very appropriate, I think, because it's representative of the fact that the international transparency movement is more than just, or involves more than just activity within each nation of the world, singularly or individually, but rather can benefit from a more coordinated approach and assistance provided by international organizations of one type or another. The World Bank, for example, is very often mentioned in relation to Africa. There's sometimes controversy, frankly, as to whether the World Bank is actually part of the solution for growing transparency in Africa, or perhaps in some respects not entirely that. And UNESCO is an international organization that plays a potentially very active role in that area. And so we're looking forward to hearing a little bit about that. And then finally, from New Zealand, we bring you a story from the location of the soon to be fifth annual Information Commissioners Conference, or I should say International Conference of Information Commissioners, ICIC for short. And that's something that has developed and blossomed greatly over the last few years. The first such conference was held in Bonn, Germany, 5 years ago. The second one was in Johannesburg, South Africa. Then there was another one in Mexico, and then I had the pleasure of meeting a number of the participants here at the fourth international conference in Manchester, England, at the end of May of 2006. And now the fifth International Conference of Information Commissioners will be held in, I believe it's Wellington, New Zealand. I'll be corrected if I'm wrong on that. And we'll have with us someone who will speak to that and give us an idea of how things are looking in that respect as well. I think it's important that everyone bear in mind that the international transparency movement has multiple dimensions, and those include not just what's being done within each country, but also what's being done on a sort of super overarching basis by other organizations, including those that are looking to develop relatively undeveloped countries in many respects, and those who are looking to just improve overall performance in this area of government activity. So with that long-winded introduction, which I will now cease to add any wind to whatsoever, let me just introduce our participants. And I hope that I will do so accurately, but please correct me if I'm wrong. First of all, from London, we have people from University College London, specifically within the School of Public Affairs, and more specifically, that would be the Constitution Unit. And let me just jump ahead a little bit and say that we have folks from University College London. We're making sure that we have that connection with London. And then we also have from the Office of UNESCO in Paris, we have Miriam Nisbet. Miriam, I hope you're there.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. We can hear you a lot better than we can hear the folks in London.
Yes, I can't hear anyone from London either.
Okay, well,
and I have my window open, so.
I can hear that Parisian traffic in the background as we speak, because it's about 10 after 4 in the afternoon your time, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, you are coming in so loud and clear that even the people in the back row of this room, where we have a thronging crowd, can hear you as well. And Miriam is the director of, and I think I'll get this correct, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the Information Society Division of UNESCO. And you also have with you, I think, another UNESCO director, and that would be Mr. Mogens Schmidt.
Yes, but Mogens is not with me yet. He was held up in another meeting, but I'm hoping he might join me at any moment. Okay. But let me just tell you who he is. Mogens is the director of the Division of Freedom of Expression, Democracy, and Peace. And we are both within the communication and information sector of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And I would say our divisions do what we can to carry out the UNESCO mandate that includes promoting the free flow of information and universal access to information.
That's great.
We are delighted to be able to wish everyone a happy International Right to Know Day.
Thank you very much, Miriam. And we're going to get back to you hopefully in just a moment, but before we go any further, I want to also introduce Andrew Ecclestone, who is, in some respects, the most important participant in the program, because Andrew is about to stay up in the middle of the night. I believe Andrew is about 2 o'clock Saturday morning in New Zealand. So you're actually a day late, so to speak, in celebrating today. We will not hold that against you in any respect whatsoever.
Thank you, Dan.
Andrew is participating not only in the middle of the night, but also he's been gracious enough to do so, fighting off a terrible cold that I think you're hoping perhaps does not reach the level of flu.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Let me just introduce you. We're doing it in a different order than intended, but that's okay. We're taking it as best as we can. Andrew is someone who's been involved in the International Transparency Movement for quite some time, going back to his days in the UK, correct?
Yeah.
And now he's working, providing assistance to the Information Commissioner / Ombudsman in New Zealand, John Belgrave, who we were all together with in Manchester at the 4th ICIC last year. And Andrew is the one who is probably the principal organizer, if that even understates it perhaps, of the 5th ICIC coming in at the end of November. Have I overstated that or not, Andrew? I'm not sure.
I don't know, Dan. I think you're stroking my ego a little bit too much, maybe.
Okay. Well, you know, it's the middle of the night. We've had communication problems, so I don't think there's any vice in that whatsoever.
Okay.
You have an idea of what we've been talking about, trying to gather together people from different parts of the world.
Yes, I know your instruction.
Of international transparency. So let me just turn it over to you if I can, but before I do so, just mention for everyone here that the 5th Annual International Conference of Information Commissioners will have representatives from dozens and dozens of nations and from a lot of, not just the officials, such as myself last year on behalf of the United States, but also NGOs, civil society members, and will be held, I believe, about the 28th of November.
That's right. But the conference runs from the 26th to the 29th of November this year.
So it will be running 2 months from today, as a matter of fact. Let me turn it over to you then, Andrew, without any further ado.
Okay. Well, I don't want to sort of run through the entire conference program. I'm sure people would want to hear all the ins and outs of it. But the conference was conferences started because commissioners realized that, as along with many other positions, that there was value in getting together to share experience, especially when there were lots of countries in the late 1990s and early 2000s that had legislated for freedom of information relatively recently. Their counterparts amongst those countries that regulate privacy laws have now been gathering together for about 30 years, I think, to swap best practice and to supervise that law. And the first couple of gatherings in Germany and South Africa were commissioner-only affairs, but when the Mexican commissioners decided to host the event in 2005, they also opened the proceedings to non-commissioners, so civil servants from governments around the world, academics and people from interest groups, NGOs if you like, were also invited. And the same occurred also in Manchester last year. This year we decided, we offered to host the conference here in New Zealand to celebrate 25 years of the New Zealand Official Information Act, it's called here, not Freedom of Information Act, but Official Information Act, being enacted in this country in 1982. And that swept away the Official Secrets Act that New Zealand had inherited from the UK as a former colony, now member of the Commonwealth, and replaced its presumption of official secrecy with a presumption of a right to know, so that people can request information from government. So we're having a 4-day-long conference. The first day will actually be a closed session for commissioners to allow them to talk a bit of housekeeping and shop amongst themselves and to make some decisions probably about future conferences. But then we have 3 days of open sessions, and we've got a number of aims for the conference this year. And they're not in particular priority, but I'll go through them in sort of number order. One, we wanted to raise the profile of the law here in New Zealand, because in some ways, quite unusually, New Zealand has not faced challenges to its law, or not faced significant challenges to its law in the 25 years since it's passed. Many other countries have found that once they've legislated for openness, a few years down the line, another government comes into power, or the existing government has been in power for a long time and it becomes a little bit uncomfortable with the rigours of openness laws, and they try to amend these laws to weaken them or to enter new grounds for withholding information when people request it. And in New Zealand, that's actually not happened
for 5 years.
And in some ways, that lack of, legislative pressure has made people in some ways a little complacent, perhaps.
Andrew?
Yes?
May I just interrupt for a moment to cover something that I neglected to emphasize to all the people who are here today? I should have mentioned that New Zealand in particular is a nation that is way out ahead, or has been way out ahead, of other nations, and that is to say that after we had Sweden, Finland, and the United States, then the next three nations of the world were New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, the Commonwealth nations. So your nation there has a very, very long, exceptionally long history, as you say, going back now to, I think, 1983.
Yeah.
That puts you in a very special standing in the world community. I just wanted to make sure the people here in Washington understood that as well.
Yeah. That's right. I think it would be fair to say that of those three, Australia, Canada and New Zealand, that legislated in the early 1980s, New Zealand's law over time and the way that it's been interpreted and enforced by the Ombudsman has produced probably one of the more open systems of government around the world. In New Zealand, it's no longer controversial even to get access to cabinet papers here. Quite often you will get cabinet papers about new legislative proposals are disclosed by the government, and sometimes they're even disclosed proactively without having to wait for a request from a member of the public or a journalist or from an interest group.
Well, would that mean, Andrew, that if there were a counterpart to, say, Mr. Karl Rove in New Zealand, he would not have the flexibility to work with near the secrecy that is available to him here in the United States?
No, he wouldn't. I mean, I think there's been controversy in the U.S. In recent years about parts of the executive claiming that they are outside the scope, perhaps, of some of the strictures of U.S. openness laws or record-keeping laws, and that's certainly not been the case here. There have been interesting... I mean, there are always constitutional challenges to do with governments and openness laws. One of the interesting features in New Zealand is that in the last 10 years it's changed its electoral system so that it's no longer first past the post, but an electoral system called mixed member proportional. And that's changed the way that governments are formed after a general election. There's lots more bargaining and jockeying for position amongst parties after, because none of them since this change in the electoral system have had an outright majority. And we had an interesting series of requests after the last general election where people were seeking information to do with the advice to the Governor General, who is the head of state, the Queen's representative here in New Zealand, who helps sort of decide who should be the leading party in government after an election. People were seeking the advice that had been provided on that, and that was withheld because there needed to be space. It was recognised that there needed to be space for people to have discussions after an election to sort of jockey for position, as it were, and for the Governor General to receive candid advice about what would be a stable and sustainable government without worrying about that being exposed. So there are limits. Even to New Zealand's greater openness with things like cabinet papers being published, there's still a space for private advice. Would you like me to get back to the conference now, though?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, thank you. It's just very interesting.
Sorry, there are many interesting byways in freedom of information that you can wander down if you're not careful. The conference is aiming to sort of raise the profile of freedom of information within New Zealand and perhaps to sort of make people recognise that a right that they have perhaps become to take for granted here in New Zealand is still something that people are struggling to turn into a practical reality in many other countries, but also that those countries that have been legislating more recently have perhaps innovated in a way that the framers of the New Zealand law couldn't have imagined 25 years ago. Quite apart from anything else, there was no World Wide Web or frequent access to electronic information by the public in the early 1980s. And more modern freedom of information laws in particular have requirements for proactive publication of certain information by governments, and that's an area where New Zealand's law is more or less silent. It doesn't have any strictures saying that departments have to publish certain categories of information. So that's an area where perhaps New Zealand will learn from overseas experience. The second main aim of the conference is to talk about freedom of information role in development within less well-off countries. You mentioned in your introductory remarks how freedom of information is now seen as a very important tool for fighting corruption in countries. And major donor organizations like the World Bank, like the UNDP, and so on, have begun to realize that simply pushing anti-corruption measures on countries as part of conditions on giving aid has not been entirely successful, and that actually freedom of information laws, which empower people, if you like, to be their own anti-corruption police, give them the tools to say what's going on with our money, or the money that people overseas are kind enough to lend or give us, are valuable instruments in helping to ensure that the aid actually reaches the people that need it. But freedom of information in some ways is just a single step amongst the spectrum of openness measures. There are sort of quite valid arguments amongst development professionals that a sectoral approach to openness is sometimes more useful, with measures to require, for example, more openness in logging industries or those industries which extract minerals such as oil, gas mining. Because that's anywhere where you're talking about exploitation of natural resources, there's rich scope for corruption if you're not careful. And some countries will struggle, to put it bluntly, to have sufficient civil service or institutional capacity to have an ombudsman or an information commissioner to investigate complaints, or have the ability to train the civil service in how to operate and make effective these laws. So there are some interesting issues that we'll be talking about at the conference here about taking forward freedom of information into more countries in the future.
Andrew, you mentioned logging interests,
yeah,
just as sort of a by-the-way example. Am I reading too much into it to think that you might have that thought in your mind because of the major human rights decision that was issued by the Inter-American Conference on Human Rights just last year,
that found that three environmental activists in Chile had the right to access to records pertaining to a controversy in the logging industry there, and that they had that right as a basic human right. Was that just a coincidence, or did you have in the back of your mind that that major world court decision?
To be honest, it's a happy coincidence, but you're quite right to highlight the importance of that judgment from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. That was the first time that an international sort of juridical body had said that there is a fundamental right to know, and that Chile, which I think had recognized this right in its constitution, but hadn't yet legislated to give practical effect to this right, had breached its constitutional obligations to people and therefore needed to take steps to remedy this failure. Most importantly, in other words, to actually legislate to give practical effect to the right to know.
Yes.
And I think that's been extremely significant.
As a matter of fact, one of our crack research assistants here with this enterprise just found recently that 2006 decision came down in September last year in the Reyes case. I guess it's Juan Reyes et al. Versus Chile, now as recently as of just last month, been used by Chile's highest court to issue a ruling in the Claude and others case that applied that same principle within the Chilean system directly. So it already is spreading beyond the intergovernmental or interagency inter-American court level to the highest court of that one nation.
And I think if other countries within the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Court have not yet legislated for freedom of information, if they were to find that if there were instances going through their domestic courts where people were seeking information, I'm sure that various groups would seek to put amicus curiae before them, encouraging them to look at the Reyes judgment and to keep that in mind when considering their own cases.
And you also mentioned, I picked up, you were talking about mineral rights in developing countries, and that reminded me of a program that I just had the opportunity to attend this past week at the National Academy of Public Administration, together with one of the members of our audience here, Daniel Stoller, who's a fellow at NAPA, and a fellow member with me on the International Affairs panel. And we heard a presentation on behalf of the World Bank Institute focusing in on mineral-rich portions of Africa and how there are tremendous corruption problems. And we were talking just this past week about how freedom of information legislation can be a viable means to an end to fight the tremendous potential for corruption, I guess not just with respect to mineral rights, but with oil and gas as well. So what you're saying certainly resonates with what we're hearing in Washington as well.
Good. I suppose the final theme of the conference really is to give people in the freedom of information community, if you like, a chance to talk a bit of shop and to gather together. It's important that commissioners have a chance to swap ideas and experiences. But it's also important that commissioners hear from those outside governments with experience of freedom of information. Too often that perhaps commissioners may occasionally talk to each other, but will be more frequently in a dialogue with civil servants in their own country. So it's sometimes important to hear the perspective of other countries, but also to hear the perspective of interest groups, NGOs, academics, and so on, who sometimes can bring a quite sharp critique to what is going on in particular countries, and perhaps hold commissioners to account. One of the sessions that we'll be having in the conference is to say, what happens in terms of holding information commissioners to account? Not all commissioners are subject to their own freedom of information laws.
Oh my goodness.
Our office, for example, is not subject to the Official Information Act.
Does that mean that sometimes...
Whereas the UK Information Commissioner, Richard Thomas, is subject to his own law.
Well, Richard is certainly a strong example of someone operating in bright sunshine there. But does that mean that there's actually sometimes
secrecy about the business of transparency?
There necessarily has to be, I think, a degree of confidence that when government has to be certain that when the Ombudsman or Information Commissioner of a country is investigating a complaint that they've not disclosed information that they should have done under the law, that when they give the information in question to the Ombudsman, that the Ombudsman isn't going to abuse their duties under the law and start disclosing the information themselves. It's not for the Information Commissioner or Ombudsman to be disclosing the information. They simply review the information and say whether or not they think it should be disclosed or should have been disclosed properly under the law. And when they make a decision, they would expect the department in question to then comply with that recommendation or order and disclose the information afterwards if they feel it should be disclosed. This is more to do with making sure that if you say that part of a Freedom of Information Law's function in public policy terms is to ensure that there's accountability in the political system for the actions of the executive and occasionally the legislature, some countries' laws bring the legislature within the scope of freedom of information as well, if part of that is to deliver accountability and that it's a healthy tension within the system, then we have to say, is there that healthy tension on information commissioners themselves, and what happens if that tension isn't actually in play? In New Zealand, for example, while we're not subject to our own Official Information Act, we do report to a select committee of Parliament, so a small committee of MPs are supposed to hold us to account and to scrutinise our annual report and take evidence from us whenever they feel like it. But some commentators might feel that perhaps Parliament has not been desperately energetic in holding our office to account. And so we're going to debate issues like that as well.
We have had similar concerns in other contexts here in the United States, where people have thought that our relatively new democratic Congress has not been, as you so quaintly phrased it, desperately energetic in pursuing certain things under certain circumstances. So again, what you're saying does indeed resonate within the experience that we have here. Andrew, would you say that it's a fair summary of the thrust of the ICIC, at least in part, that it would permit representatives of nations that have not yet reached the point of enactment of their transparency law to come and share with the world, or learn from the world community the value of that, as well as perhaps the tribulations of implementing it, and also, perhaps just as importantly, representatives of NGOs from those nations who can come and not only speak with other information commissioners of other nations that have laws, but also NGOs of those nations to learn how to then mobilize to provide pressure toward having those laws. I imagine you have a lot of NGO activity for them. I remember a good deal of it, for example, in Manchester last year.
Yes, I think that's a useful summary. I mean, we are certainly hoping for government and civil society representatives from countries that have not yet legislated for freedom of information to attend and to be able to learn and ask questions of those that have passed laws, whether they're New Zealand, which passed it 25 years ago, or countries such as Mexico that only enacted the law 5 years ago, but many would feel have taken huge strides, perhaps leading other countries significantly in terms of what they do in terms of their law and practice. And the New Zealand Overseas Aid Agency has supported us in this aim of the conference, and they are giving us funding to bring people, 21 people from different Pacific nations, Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, and so on, to attend the conference, and also just over half a dozen people to come from South American countries, from Chile, Argentina, and Brazil, to also attend the conference. So there'll be a fair spread of people from around the Pacific that will be attending, yes.
What made me think of that, Andrew, more than anything else, is that I just happened to notice yesterday that one of the nations in which International Right to Know Day is being celebrated is Swaziland, where there's a group getting together in, it looks like it's Manzini City, if I'm pronouncing that correctly,
And part of that effort there is to pressure the government toward more actively considering the adoption of freedom of information. And that's just an example that if a representative of a group such as that in that nation were to come to the ICIC and learn more and network, to use that word very loosely, that would further spur those activities in that nation.
Yes, I don't actually think we've got someone from Swaziland registered to come, but they'd be very welcome if they wanted to, and they were able to find the funding to come. I think part of the problem in some ways it sounds silly because every country in the world is a long way from somewhere, but New Zealand is particularly a long way from most places, actually. And so there have certainly been issues this year to do with people wanting to come from countries which are a long way from New Zealand but having difficulty finding the funding to come.
Well, then,
I think this is part of one of the issues that I think we would like international donor organizations to consider is if they think there's a strong gain to be had from developing nations to legislate for freedom of information, that they need to help people come to this conference or to future conferences. The World Bank Institute is helping a number of people come to this year's conference, and we would hope that that activity increases in future years so that other NGOs and developing nation governments are able to come and hear these debates.
I do not know what the funding situation is in UNESCO, but I wonder if there's a possibility of room for further work there as well. I don't want to put anyone on the spot in this program, certainly, but that makes me think of that as well. I wonder, you say that Wellington is in Wellington, not often, right?
No, Wellington.
Wellington, okay. That's what I thought, but I want to be sure. I know it's a big country.
Yeah.
Although it's far away from many parts of the world, there are offsetting advantages because New Zealand is so beautiful, et cetera, et cetera. Are you in a position, by the way, looking forward, and again, this might tie to secrecy about transparency, are you in a position yet to speak to where the next, looking beyond your conference in November, where the next, the sixth annual IC might be? Has that been established yet?
No, it hasn't been established, and I'm not withholding any information from you there, Dan.
Oh. And you're not glomerizing. It's not that you're neither confirming nor denying there, Andrew.
No, there's no NCND policy here.
Okay. By the way, this is sort of an arcane point, but if you did have something akin to the exclusion that's in our FOIA here available, you could nevertheless be denying any information even though it did exist. But that would be a very rare circumstance indeed. I do remember when we were in Manchester last year that when John was talking about the possibility of the fifth ICIC being in New Zealand either in the fall or, depending upon budgetary considerations, early 08. We were talking with another John Reed, in Canada, about the possibility of it being there. So if I had to personally hazard a guess, I would guess that perhaps Canada might be a logical location, all the more so because when we started scouring the internet to see where the activity was this year for International Rights to Know Day 2007, we saw more events, more things going on in Canada than just about anywhere else in the world. So much was being done there at the provincial level, from British Columbia at one end all the way to Tiny Prince Edward Island at the other end of the nation. There seemed to be something going on with respect to this. So Canada, again, being one of the three that came online with New Zealand and Australia many, many years ago, for that reason as well, seems to me to be a good candidate. If you need people to apply pressure to John Reed, I'd be glad to volunteer to contribute to that.
Well, I think you should be sparing John Reed any pressure. Actually, he retired earlier this year. His successor, Robert Marlowe, might be interested in the suggestion, though. But I think it's interesting that you say that about Canada. One of the innovations in Canada in the recent past that the UK sought to emulate when it was implementing freedom of information, and that I worked in the UK government briefly after it enacted its law, but before it came into to help them implement the law. One of the things we had, saw had happened in Canada and we thought was a good thing to copy was that a university there, the University of Alberta Extension, had created a program to run, to train freedom of information officers from government agencies across the entire country in how to operate the law there, because they felt that it was perhaps too haphazard to leave it to the training budgets of individual departments. Perhaps it would slip down their order of priorities. And the, although each province had its own law, as well as their federal law, the content of the course at Alberta was designed so that it would cover the core elements of all right to know laws, and then would allow that to be tailored for individual provinces and the federal level. And John Reid made the point in Canada last year, which I think was very significant, that he now wouldn't employ anybody in his office as information commissioner who hadn't been on that course. And I think that was important because it was about the professionalisation of freedom of information officials within government and within his office to say this is a particular skill and a particular knowledge base, and it's worth cultivating this so that people take on the core precepts of this, because it's quite a difficult job being a freedom of information officer in a government department. Sometimes you face pressure from your superiors to keep information secret at the same time as you're facing pressure from the requester to have the information disclosed. And learning how to navigate that process and to persuade your superiors that the law requires the information to be disclosed, or to be able to explain to requesters that actually there are good grounds, perhaps in a public interest situation, to withhold information from disclosure is important skills, are important skills to have.
That's a very important point. And it ties very directly to work that's been done by a group called the American Society of Access Professionals here that's existed for more than 25 years. There is a Canadian version of it. The U.S. version is abbreviated ASAP, which has a double meaning, of course. Timeliness being a major issue with the implementation of our own FOIA. And the Canadian version, I think, is CAPA, C-A-P-A. And it just so happens that one of the other attendees of this program here in Washington is a former president of the American Society of Access Professionals, Will Ferrajaro, and Will is very familiar with the efforts in this country to focus on professionalism of freedom of information officers, which is to the advantage of not only the people in the government, but the people outside of the government who are served by the people in the government as well. And I'm going to imagine, based upon what I recall of the program in Manchester last year, that there will be some portion of your program that will be touching on that as well, the importance of professionalism in implementation of law.
Yes, in fact, we have invited as one of our guest speakers, Mark Aurel Ratio, who was recently in the Information Commissioner's Office in Canada, and who is one of the professors on the course at Alberta, to come and talk to us about training for officials and how integral that is to actually creating a culture of openness.
So it's just another example of the role and the value that can be served by the IC getting together every year and covering different aspects of freedom of information, not only adoption to those nations of the world that need to do more to get to that point, but implementation immediately upon adoption, such as where they are in the UK now, and then even further down the road when you're talking about refinement of implementation, where you have the luxury, so to speak, after there's been a culture change within the nation, of getting to the more micro things that still need focus, like professionalism amongst the career cadre that implement the law.
I think more and more people are realizing that simply enacting a freedom of information statute is not sufficient. That's only the beginning of the process. If you say that, I mean, a freedom of information law is not the end point of what you want to achieve. The end point is to have a more open democratic society, better accountability, better formulation of other government policies so that they achieve the ends that governments desire and that people have elected them to achieve, whether it's better health services or higher quality education for children. have to make sure that you're implementing your openness policy well, and it's not simply a question of enacting a law and just saying, well, now get on and operate the law.
I can certainly relate that to my own experience, Andrew. As you know, having met with hundreds, or I guess more than 250 delegations of what I would call foreign visitors, representatives of other nations since 1981, interested in the first the adoption and then the implementation of their law, I certainly saw a trend over the years. In the very early 80s, it was focused on adoption. But then over the years, at the Office of Information Privacy at the Justice Department where I was, I saw a number of nations coming through focusing on implementation. In other words, they already were members of the club, so to speak, but they were very interested in how the United States implemented its law to learn what could be learned from our system, to take the good and to be wary of the bad, so to speak, in order to move things further. So that fits very well with what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question, I guess, again with respect to the member of our audience who I mentioned earlier, who was the former president of the American Society of Access Professionals, Will Ferrajaro. I know he came back not too long ago from visiting two nations in, maybe showing my ignorance of basic geography, in the Balkans, Montenegro and Macedonia. Hey, I got it the first try. Look at that. And I know Will would be curious, based upon the work that he did in those two nations just a few months ago, as to whether you knew off the top of your head, and I'm guessing you do, knowing you, Andrew, how careful you are with detail and the like, whether you know whether there are any members of representatives from those nations who are going to be attending 2 months from now in Wellington.
I think sadly at the moment there aren't. People from Macedonia did express an interest in coming, but as Will will not be surprised to hear, there are issues to do with funding for public servants to attend. And so sadly I think the new information commissioner from Macedonia won't be able to come. I mean, one of the things I think that future conferences will have to sort of confront, and perhaps information commissioners will have to discuss at this year's conference, is to say how much of a duty does the organizing host commissioner have in terms of trying to drum up funding to enable people to attend the conference. I mean, part of my job this year in some ways has been not just to organize the program for the conference and hopefully that we've got plenty of things to talk about, but also to try and find some funding to enable people to attend. But that in itself is a full-time job, and I think perhaps that's something that we need to consider for future conferences, is to make sure that people are able to attend. And that's been an issue even for people from the US, there's one commissioner and one sort of quasi commission within the states of the US, and both of them have had issues in terms of finding money to attend the conference this year.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm amazed. Who are you counting as the quasi commissioner? Would that be Bob Friedman in New York?
Yeah, that would be. Yeah.
Okay. And I'm very hopeful that the Justice Department is paying for at least one representative to attend over there. And as a matter of fact, I was hopeful that there would be two, because one of the attorneys in my office, who was very active in this area, as a matter of fact, practiced law in New Zealand for several years before joining my staff. And I was imagining before I retired that Brent would be able to attend as well. But apparently that hasn't happened. Well, listen, Andrew, it certainly sounds like you've had more than one full-time job in preparing for this. And I'm sorry to have added to your time, and but so grateful that you have been with us, not only in the middle of the night there, but also when you've been under the weather as well. And ordinarily, I would say, please stay with us, but again, recognizing it's so late, perhaps what we'll do is say goodbye to you at this point with our thank yous, and then shift over to the next geographic location, and then take it from there.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to stay on the line if you would like me to, but otherwise, I would say thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this. I'm not sure actually how many people you've got in the room listening to me, but it's been a pleasure talking to you and discussing the conference. And of course, if people would like to about the conference. I'm very happy for them to consult the website or to get in touch with our office. And we'll be putting the conference papers online afterwards. We're still not sure whether we are going to be able to juggle our budget to be able to videotape and webcast the proceedings of the conference for those that can't make it, but we hope that we'll be able to do that.
Thank you very much again, Andrew. And we are, for not just the throngs of people who are here today, but also for others interested, we're creating a podcast of this as well. And that's something that we'll make available to you and others throughout. But please, everyone here, join me.
Hi, Sarah. This is Amir Giannico of the Washington College of Law. You're on with David Metcalf and the whole room.
Hey, great. Well, I'm here.
Everyone's very happy to hear you hooked up. We're now going to London with that part of our program. But let me reiterate the reintroduction as well, because we have been doing things in one sequence or another here.
Okay.
And Sarah is a very senior research fellow at University College London, where they have been working very closely, exceptionally closely with the UK government in implementing their role there for now coming up on 3 years. And it's kind of a unique situation, not only because they're the largest nation to come online, so to speak, in the world community in the last few years, last 5 or 6 years, the other two being Mexico and Japan, I think, but they really are working very much hand in hand with, and Sarah, you'll correct me, I'm sure, but what used to be the Lord Chancellor's office and then became known as the Constitution Department, perhaps, but now is most currently called the Ministry of Justice?
That's basically correct, yep.
Basically correct. Okay, I will settle for being at least basically correct.
It's changed names twice in the past few years.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to convey. It is the counterpart to our Department of Justice, and then recognizing that it's a parliamentary system, also at least part of our White House counsel's office, so to speak.
Right.
Otherwise just known loosely there as Whitehall. Is that fair?
It is part of Whitehall.
Part of Whitehall, yes. Part of Whitehall. Okay.
Whitehall refers generally to central government.
Yes, I got it. And I think I follow what you're saying, central as opposed to local government.
Right.
And that brings up a point that I know you'll be speaking about, and I think you might have Mark Lover there with you as well.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Hello,
Mark, who is someone who's worked very hard in this area as well at University College London. And that just makes a quick point, which I'll make before finally turning it over to you.
Okay.
And that is, in the UK, it's very different from the United States, whereas here we have our national government, and after our FOIA was enacted in 1966, then eventually, one by one, the states, territories, District of Columbia, developed their own counterpart, the Freedom of Information Act, sometimes it's called open government, open meetings laws, it varies from state to state. Whereas in the UK, everything is all together, so when you came online, so to speak, 2 years ago, January, which was January 05, suddenly you had well more than 100,000 governmental units, including members of the National Health Service, police constabularies, down to the smallest little rock on the Isle of Wight, perhaps, that were subject to the national law. And you focus both on what you call central government, but as well as the law being applicable down to the sort of the micro-government units as well, which makes it a major, major undertaking, to say the least. Have I understated the strength of the undertaking there? Perhaps so.
No, I think you covered it quite well.
Okay. Well, I will stop making that point and finally appreciate very much your being there and turn it over to you for a bit.
Okay. Well, the way we're going to handle this is Mark and I are sharing this short phone presentation, and he'll start off, and then I'll go, and he'll finish up.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to start just by briefly setting the scene about what we do. We are called the Constitution Unit, so I'm sure our website is knocking around somewhere there, but for your reference, you can find it at www.ucl.ac.uk.
Holding it in my hand, Mark, as we speak.
constitution-unit. We are an academic think tank, which is to say that we are situated in a university and we try and do academically rigorous and credible work, but we try and walk a thin line between that and pragmatic policy advice. In terms of FOI and secrecy, we are a small research and events team situated at the unit itself, but with a network of experts and consultants who are mainly former officials in Whitehall, in central government, with expertise in FOI, data protection, record management, and they've been closely involved with training and advising the government since running up to implementation in 2005 and since then as well. And the unit has also been involved in advising parliamentary committees and other parts of government throughout that time as well.
I'm going to talk very briefly about the kind of the characteristics of our law extremely quickly, just to give you an overview, and then what some of the more interesting happenings since implementation are. And then Mark will finish up by talking about a research project that we do, that we're doing right now, on the success, the quote-unquote success of the FOI Act. So first of all, as you said, Dan, we've had FOI since 2005, although it was actually passed at the end of 2000. So it took a full 4 years between passage and coming into force for government to get up to speed and ready to comply with the Act. We have here in the UK two FOI Acts, actually. There's the FOI Act 2000, which is applicable to England, Northern Ireland, and Wales. And we have the Scottish Act, the FOI Scotland Act of 2002, which came into force at the same time, but it is the authorities subject to that are the local authorities, the police, and so forth in Scotland. As you said, we have over 110,000 public authorities which are subject to the Act in all parts of the public sector. And it is actually not known exactly how many, but we're talking about from the biggest central government departments to your individual general practitioner's office that are subject to the Act. The Act is implemented across all levels of government.
That's through, just for the benefit of people here who might not have seen Michael Moore's movie Sicko, that's through the National Health Service in the UK.
Yeah.
Where down to the smallest level of medical providers, there is sufficient government involvement that places them under your FOIA. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's right.
I just wanted, for the benefit of our audience here, to make sure that everyone understood it's very, very different than it is here in the United States.
Governmental,
yeah,
not private.
That's correct. So all of these authorities are subject to the same Act. And they all became subject to the Act at the same time, so there wasn't a rollout across parts of the public sector, which is what they had originally planned. They had planned to bring in, for example, local authorities, and then perhaps health, and then central government, or maybe not in that order, but they decided in the end to bring it in at the same time. The Act is, there are no fees for making an FOI request here, and that, as some people may know, is a real source of controversy. There have been some proposals made to change that, but at this point, when you make an FOI request in the UK, and you can make it from anywhere in the world, you don't have to pay anything.
Sarah, I just saw someone in the audience writing very vigorously when you said no fees.
Yeah.
And I saw that person's eyes light up as if that person were thinking, my goodness, there is no limitation whatsoever.
That's not true. Actually,
yes.
First of all, government department or public authorities can charge for things like photocopying or printing or postage. That does not happen very often at all. The other way that an authority can charge is if the amount of time to locate and collate the information takes more than 2.5 days of a civil servant's work. Either they can refuse the request, it's exempt, or they can charge for that, and then the requester does have to pay, and it's at a rate of £600 for 2.5 days of work, central government, £450 for local government, or the authority can just carry on and respond to the request over the time limit and not charge at all.
So it sounds as if there are no fees, yet at the same time a pretty potent, perhaps even formidable ceiling that can be placed on FOIA requests.
Yeah, that's right, but I don't think that it has, I don't know how often that is used, but my understanding is that it is not used that often, that requesters are charged that. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
Please proceed. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, a couple other things. We have 23 exemptions, the majority of which are covered by what we call the public interest test, which means the public authority has to balance whether withholding or disclosing is in the public interest. We have a four-stage appeal process. So the first stage, if a requester is not happy with the response, they can file an internal review with the same department and ask them to review it. Then they can go to what we have called the information commissioner. If they're still not happy, they can then take it up to the level called information tribunal, which will hear an appeal and make a judgment. And then finally, on a point of law, they could take it to the High Court here in the UK. And then one other small point is that for central government, we do have something called a clearinghouse, which is housed within the Ministry of Justice, and they coordinate requests, for example, what they call round-robin requests, which are requests, the same requests made to various departments, or requests that are quite sensitive. So those are the main characteristics of our act. Now, since FOI has come into force, we've had hundreds of thousands of requests. The central government keeps the best statistics on this, and as of June of this year, so 2.5 years in, 89,600 requests have been made to central government. Local authorities actually receive the most requests in the UK, and we estimate, these estimates are based on surveys of local authorities. We estimate that in the first 2 years, over 130,000 requests were made. Police also keep good statistics, and they estimate that about 36,000 requests were made in the first 2 years. So those three parts of the public sector, we have fairly accurate, if not very accurate, numbers. Now,
that's a lot of activity, to be sure.
Yes, a lot, and perhaps one could say that that's due somewhat to the fact that there is no fee for making them. We are quite interested in how journalists use the Act, and the reason for that is that they're obviously the most quote-unquote visible users, in that a lot of what they find out through FOI they publish. Therefore, the media put FOI out there in the public view. And in the UK, they are consistently, a group that is consistently named in the top three groups of requesters, the other two being members of the public or private individuals and businesses. We have done some work on how the media use FOI and how much they use it, and we think roughly 1,500 to 1,800 articles per year are published in the UK national papers, which mention FOI, and that can either be because they're about FOI or because the journalist has used FOI to get information.
Do you have any preliminary statistics, Sarah, on the percentage of total requests? I know it can vary from central government.
Yeah, that is not possible to say, and the reason it is not possible is that the FOI request is requester blind, so no one has to reveal who he or she is when they make a request. Any estimate of who's making the request is based purely on the fact that some authorities do try to keep track and some just guess. And the guesses that we're getting are from mostly local authorities.
Sarah, that sounds very, very familiar to me compared to the situation in the United States. In other words, we're very commonly asked, nice to use the word we. As if I were still living in the U.S.
sort of thing, but very frequently asked from all different sorts of people, well, what percentage total media? We're guessing about 5% or so.
Uh-huh.
It really is not much more than a guess.
Right.
So what you're saying rings true within our experience here in the United States as well.
Yeah, I would guess roughly. I mean, you know, obviously journalists need a lot of their information right away, and so FY doesn't work in that sense. But for the investigative stories and the ones where they have time to gather information, it can be quite useful.
I'm just curious. This is perhaps a relatively minor point, but it just popped in my head based upon what you said. Have you yet been in a situation, to your knowledge, in the UK where you have found some journalists to be proprietary over the requests that they have made, even to the point of saying, my goodness, don't release to another journalist the fact that I made this subject matter request, because that's indicative of my own work, my work product as a journalist, it has proprietary value to me.
No, they can't do that. I mean, it could be that journalists want to be able to say that, but government, you know, the whole idea behind the act is releasing information. It's not about giving journalists information and the right to have that information, and only they can have it.
Well, frankly, we have, upon occasion, had situations here with journalists feeling differently about that, so maybe it's...
Yeah, they feel differently about it, but it doesn't necessarily work in their favor.
Good point. Thank you.
And then the final thing I just wanted to bring up was the fact that generally FOI the FOI Act is considered here to be a very good thing, but there are a lot of problems with compliance. Obviously, it's only the first 2.5 years, so that makes sense. Some of those problems are procedural, you know, just getting the processes in order and then well oiled. Some complain about the lack of resources, the fact that they have to meet deadlines that can be quite tough. There is a 20-day working day deadline, by the way, here. I forgot to mention that. So an authority has 20 days to respond to a request.
That sounds familiar here, too, as well.
Yeah, exactly. And then there are problems with difficult requests, you know, ones that where the requester says, give me everything you have on such and such, and that can just be, you know, an onerous task. Finding information within the organization and coordinating with other parts of the organization to get the relevant info. And then finally, they have difficulty still with applying the public interest test. That's all I'm going to say right now about what's happened in the past couple of years. And Mark will finish it up.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I'm just going to briefly tell you about what it is we actually do here. As far as we know, FOI is a fairly under-researched subject, both in terms of practitioners and academics. So we're currently trying to rectify that situation, and we're studying. We've got quite a large study of FOI in central government, which has two aspects: both whether it's achieving its objectives and what effect is it having on Whitehall, the UK Central Civil Service. And it's quite a tricky task in a sense. What we've tried to do is work out what the objectives of FOI are, which is not as simple as it sounds, because the UK Act has no purpose clause in it. So we've got to try and ascribe some objectives to it, which are along the lines of increased transparency and accountability, public participation, and so on. And also work out the key characteristics, kind of constitutionally and organizationally, of the UK Civil Service. Also the ones which were most worried about when FOI came into force. And
Mark,
ascertain whether the objectives have been achieved and whether these aspects of the civil service have been affected at all since FOI came in.
Mark, if you had to characterize, and this is maybe an unfair question because it's highly subjective, of course, what I'm about to ask, but if you had to characterize the extent to which you think that government employees in the UK at all levels overall have been able to achieve the culture change necessary to move from pre-FOIA to FOIA implementation, now in the last, 12, 24, I guess more than 30 months, do you think that overall they're 50% there yet, or less than 50%, or more than 50%? Do you have a sense of that?
It's difficult to say, partly because it's quite likely to be different between central and local government. Some people make the point that the further away you get from the center of power, the more FOI has achieved a cultural change, perhaps because there's been less of a culture to change. And also, even within parts of central government, there are things which look like culture change across the board. There's also the impression that the parts of central government which are used to dealing with FOI, which are there in order to deal with FOI or information more generally, they are starting to change culturally, but there are large parts of organizations for whom FOI is not properly part of the day job yet. It's an extra burden. So it's extremely difficult to say, and we haven't managed to start. The main way we're hoping to get to the bottom of this is through interviews, and we haven't managed to start these interviews yet. So it's a little bit early to say, I think, I'm afraid.
But you are nevertheless, comparatively speaking, way ahead of the United States, where we enacted our law in mid-66. It had a year for implementation, so it came into effect mid-1967. And then it took many, many years, the remainder of the 1960s, through the early 1970s, really up until our Watergate crisis in 73 and 74, before there was sufficient focus on the weaknesses of our law. So all I'm saying is that you're ahead of the game, so to speak, as compared to the United States, that you're even thinking about this and focusing on the success of implementation and the improvements or refinements that could be made just 2.5 years out.
Well, we can take heart from that then. they are the main two aspects of the study. We are hoping, we're not addressing any kind of aspects relating to fees, and we're also we're not sure if we can get to the financial cost aspect of the Act. But apart from that, we are hoping that the research will have a fairly practical use, in that, as both you and Sarah have hinted at, the subject of revision and amendment is already on the cards. And
that right there is remarkable compared to the United States experience. The very fact that you are thinking and speaking about revision and amendment just 2.5 years out is progressive, relatively speaking, compared to our experience.
Yes, depending on which way the changes and amendments go.
Good point.
One thing which we're hoping we might be able to feed into in terms of kind of a worry on the part of the government and therefore potentially regressive revision is the idea of a policy space between ministers and civil servants, where they have their crucial discussions about policy, whether this is protected enough. Over the last maybe 6 months, there's been discussion that a lot of the things which the officials and ministers are worried that what they say doesn't have sufficient protection, and that therefore they can't say it properly, and their discussions are hampered because of this. This is a real worry for them, and we're hoping that this is something we will get at in the study, which can then inform the kind of debate about amendment revision later in the day.
That makes sense, Mark, from the U.S. experience as well. We would call that our deliberative process privilege.
Okay.
And frankly, the stakes become higher now at this point, this time with electronic communications, where you're not just worried about the candor necessary in old-fashioned, very formal type of memorandum communication, but given the relatively informality with which even significant things are discussed and communicated through electronic mail, the potential for things simply put being reduced to writing that people would prefer not to be disclosed, perhaps they're not even aware that they're reducing it to writing because they're on their BlackBerries in the middle of the night, not entirely focusing on what they're saying, or maybe sometimes how they're saying it, that sort of raises the stakes in that area, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does indeed. I mean, I think central government has been advised that all emails should be written now on the record effectively, but, I mean, it must be quite difficult to change the working practice.
Yes. Mark and Sarah, we have a question from our audience here, if you could take a moment.
Sure.
I'll pass it along to you in case the acoustics are not quite ideal.
I just wondered if there was a case in point about Mark's concern there about the advice between civil servant and minister. Is there a case that is catalyzing the concern about that?
Were you able to hear that, folks?
Not very well.
Okay, the question is, this new area of concern, and I guess Mark introduced it by saying it might even be an area of regressive refinement of your law, if that's a proper phrase, the area, the space between the minister and the top level career civil servant, is there a particular case that has catalyzed the concern there? So often, at least in the United States, there can be concern that exists at an amorphous level, but when a case comes through, that becomes the focal point for commanding attention and perhaps action on it. Is there a particular instance that has driven that concern there?
There are possibly two things. The first one, there was a letter, in terms of raising awareness of the issue, there was a letter by the Secretary of State for, I think it was at the time, Trade and Industry, who wrote a letter to the Secretary of State for, I think at the time, Constitutional Affairs or perhaps Justice, but in any case, the lead minister on FOI, expressing the worry, his worry as a minister for precisely this point. So that was something which kind of created, it raised the issue amongst the media, amongst the kind of political classes. And
did that letter itself become public?
Yes, it's on the BBC website if you'd like to read it.
That sounds public enough to me, yes.
And there have been a couple of specific cases. It's also related to the issue of cabinet collectivity, the idea that what the cabinet says should remain private so that no differences in opinion between cabinet ministers are known. And there has been a specific case where these discussions with the in the Department of Education have been requested and finally released, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, excuse me, did you say cabinet connectivity or cabinet collectivity?
Collectivity.
Collectivity, meaning uniformity or solidarity?
Yeah, collective responsibility, indeed, yeah.
I see.
So those issues are interrelated, and the case which comes into my head is one which has, I think, both of these points and the point about it being deliberative process, as you mentioned. So that was one case, and I think you can find it went to the Information Commissioner, so you can actually read a decision about it on the Information Commissioner's website. I think there will have been others, but that's the one that comes in my head at the moment.
All right, thank you. You've given us a wealth of information, Sarah and Mark, and have rounded out very nicely our program here.
Great.
Pardon me?
Great.
Oh, great. I'm sorry. I didn't hear that. Absolutely. We're going to move now to Paris.
Okay.
And look at things with respect to the focus that is provided by an international organization. And that, as Andrew said very earlier, is the type of organization that might even contribute to the growth of world transparency by providing funding to allow NGO representatives to attend things such as his upcoming information conference of information commissioners.
Huh?
And we're going to shift there now.
Hello.
Hi, Madame. Hold on one moment. We're going to connect everybody. Here it is. Is everyone on the line?
Hello.
Area?
Yes.
Hi, this is Dan in Washington. Let me just say right up front, I very much appreciate your staying so late with our intercontinental process here. And I believe we still have on the line our folks, our friends in London.
Yep. Yes.
I said that tentatively, not being 100% certain of that, but that's really good. And we have already spoken with Andrew in New Zealand, and I think he has gone back to sleep because it's now.
Who can blame him?
Yes. And first, let me take care of the formalities here, because Mary, do we also have Mr. Schmidt as well?
No, we do not. We've lost that possibility, but that's okay.
Well, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure that I was not under-introducing him if he were there as well. So let me introduce you, and I can tell you that I want to make sure to introduce you not only with respect to your current position as Director of the Information Society Division at UNESCO in Paris, but also in relation to the fact that for the last 7 years before recently moving to Europe, you served as legislative counsel with the American Library Association. And I was reminded here today by a colleague on the faculty at American University of Washington College of Law, and apparently someone who is well known to you, Miriam, Professor Peter Yazzie, that I should definitely not understate your ALA background as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that because, in fact, libraries are very much key to freedom of information. And libraries the world over, and certainly the American Library Association, where I was for seven, almost 8 years, are among the institutions that most have been advocates for freedom of information. It's a core mission of libraries, and I'm sure that's what Peter had in mind when he said, don't underestimate that.
I think that sounds exactly right, and you are so exquisitely positioned with your background, not only in openness and government in the United States, having worked in that area for two different federal agencies, but also with your ALA background, to work in the area that involves both librarian-related issues and also openness in government as well. And isn't it really nice that now we can have this discussion with approximately 70 nations of the world having joined the Transparency Club, whereas you'll remember years ago, in the early 1980s, we had but three, the U.S., Finland, and Norway. And
yeah,
then very quickly we had the Commonwealth nations of the world, come on, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. I should probably, in the interest of public disclosure, say that Miriam and I were colleagues at the Justice Department in the early 1980s at the Office of Information Privacy when it was created back then. How is that for openness about openness?
That sounds good to me. Let me just mention, and I don't want to take more time than I'm allotted, but I do want to remind people that in addition to the mission that UNESCO has for to ensuring access to information, really as a fundamental human right, UNESCO also, and this is where I had wanted Mr. Schmidt to join us, we also very much have a strong program on freedom of expression that also relates to ensuring openness of the media, of training training journalists and trying to ensure their safety throughout the world, particularly when they're reporting on very difficult and controversial and sometimes dangerous topics. So you'll see it's a strong international element, not only of policy, but also real practical on the ground trying to ensure access.
It sounds as if UNESCO certainly covers a very important wide range of activity.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, I'll even mention with my tongue hardly in my cheek that someone suggested earlier on that UNESCO might even be able to play a role in providing some funding for more people to travel to Wellington, New Zealand for the International Conference of Information Commissioners. And we said, no, it's the World Bank Institute that tends to do more of that thing to get those NGO folks all the way to that part of the world so they can
develop transparency in additional nations.
Correct.
But with that small point aside, how are things going there in that area? You've been there now, I think, about a month or so. It probably seems as if it's been 6 months.
It's been about a month, and what I'm finding is that there are a lot of people here, not only at headquarters, but of course throughout the world at our regional field offices and field offices all over in 150 countries. But there are people whose mission is to provide access, to ensure access to information. So there's a whole an amazing network that I'm still learning about little bit by little bit that really ensures that this mission is accomplished to the best of our ability.
Have you found that the NGO organizations in Europe, those who were, I think, the driving force behind the creation of International Right to Know Day in 2002, in the Bulgaria area, have you found that they have been active with, on sort of on your radar screen there?
I think the answer is an unqualified yes. And I think if you talk to anyone who works in an international organization like UNESCO, they would say to you that without the work of the NGOs, it would be impossible to do what we have. They're not only excellent partners in actually making things happen, but they are a really strong conscience. If you don't do what you're supposed to do, they're going to be the first ones to tell you where you're missing the boat. And that's a very important role to play.
Well, on that note, I should probably candidly admit that the person who perhaps was more the prime mover behind the establishment of International Right to Know Day than anyone else, Helen Derbyshire, who works out of the Info, I think it's called InfoSec, office in Madrid, and I mean, I think it's Poyet Network office in Madrid. She was in Paris earlier today, and there was a possibility that she might even be knocking on your door to participate in this program as well. So that just illustrates your point about that, sort of looking over your shoulder, so to speak, to make sure that things are done in the right way, at least from their perspective. Tell me this. One area that people in our audience here in particular are interested in is, one area of the world, I should say, is what could be regarded now as the greatest potential growth area for international transparency, and that would be Africa. Does UNESCO, I know you mentioned that you have branch offices, so to speak, in 158 nations in the world, I think that's what you said. Do you have much of a presence in Africa? Do you see, from where you stand, your vantage point, there being much movement toward more nations joining the Transparency Club in Africa? And I guess I should preface or supplement my question by saying that it has been surprising to many people that there's still only a relative handful of African nations that have joined the club, so to speak. Not only is there more room for growth there, but things have moved surprisingly slowly there. And I wonder if you have any perspective on that that you could share with us.
Well, I can tell you that, yes, we have very important offices in Africa, and that is, again, that many of those countries are ones that I would say are on the considered among the most important places for UNESCO to work in terms of all different kinds of development, whether it's information for all, educational programs, scientific programs, and of course we work with our other UN partner agencies on all different kinds of programs. I think that for sure Africa is really
is a really critical place for us to be working. There are strong offices there. I can't give you a whole lot more perspective than that after only 1 month here. for sure, it's an important presence.
So I asked that in particular because one of the attendees at our program here in Washington, at the American University of Washington College of Law, I know mentioned to me that he just recently met with a delegation of NGO type folks from Nigeria, where they're looking to become the next nation of Africa to become a member of the International Transparency Committee. And they've had a law, legislation that has been ready to go, so to speak, for quite some time. And now they're thinking that politically the point has finally been reached where there's enough pressure on the executive there to make that a reality very soon. But even at that, that will still make only a relative handful of nations of Africa, depending upon how you want to count them. South Africa, certainly, and we're looking at Uganda and Angola and possibly Mozambique, depending on how you count them in that community. There's a long way to go, and I guess I wanted to pass that along to you as well for what it's worth, if UNESCO can play a greater role in that area. I know a very heavy one is played by the World Bank and the World Bank Institute as well. But from our perspective in the United States, from what we can see here, that really should be where the action is, so to speak, during the next decade. And certainly with a lot more to be done, or a lot more to happen in South America and Latin America, but I think without any question, the continent that holds the greatest potential is Africa. And I'm not including, of course, Antarctica, which could go from zero to one in a flash. So I just wanted to pass that along for what that's worth.
Thanks.
Okay. Anything else you see from your perspective in Paris as you approach 6 p.m. on a Friday evening with respect to the world community and what we can see coming down the road in this area?
Well, I will. I just will say, and I hope everybody there is aware of this. I would certainly hope so. I know that anyone who is attending your meeting, your celebration, has a strong interest in this area, believes in it, believes in the mission, the importance of information for all as a critical part of democracy and freedom and basic human rights. And that's really shared throughout the world. It's a very, it's something that there are people here too every day working on to make it happen. So I thank you for the celebration and thank you for including UNESCO in it.
Oh, we thank you for being part of it. Let me just say, just to reiterate, to cap things off, that this is a day that is sort of modeled again on our Freedom of Information Day in the United States. This is the fifth annual celebration of International Right to Know Day. And this program that we've had here at American University of Washington College of Law is the first time that there's ever been an event like this, a gathering of people even within the United States, let alone something of an international dimension. It's the first time this ever happened in the U.S. Since this day was established. So I want to thank you, Marion, and Paris for helping make this international component possible. And Andrew has probably gone to sleep in New Zealand at this point, and certainly our participants from University College London as well. And I want to thank everyone here for attending this program. And as it just so happens, we are being able to conclude this right on our appointed hour of noon with a two-hour program that went very well. So again, everyone here wants to... perhaps we will meet here the same time next year for the next International FOIA Day Freedom of Information Day program, or actually before then, I can tell everyone that we are looking for a program celebrating Freedom of Information Day in the United States on Monday, March 17th. As it happens, James Madison's birthday, March 16th, falls on Sunday in 2008, and there have long been programs commemorating that day at the Freedom Forum, the First Amendment Center at the Freedom Forum, which is moving to its new location on Pennsylvania Avenue, where the First Amendment will be proudly displayed on the outside of the building, down about 6th in Pennsylvania, 5th in Pennsylvania Northwest. And they will be having their program. We've already divided the days. On Friday, the 14th of March, whereas Washington College of Law is aiming toward Monday, the 17th of March. So we hope to see people who are interested in this area back again for that program at that time. Again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, folks. Thanks again. I appreciate your patience as we've gone through.